So good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me? Okay. So what I was asked to do today was to talk a little bit about the research that's ongoing in my laboratory as an example of the kinds of things that are happening here at Roswell Park in the area of lung cancer research. But in order for you to understand its context, I'm going to provide you with a little bit of background about EGFR mutant lung cancer and the use of tyrosine kinase inhibitors in the treatment of that disease. And some of this, in looking through Dr. Demi's slides, you will have seen little bits of this as part of his presentation. But hopefully I'll reinforce some of those key concepts for you. As Dr. Demi explained to you, lung cancer is still a huge problem in the United States and across the world. It's the leading cause of cancer mortality for both men and women in the U.S. And on an annual basis, more than 200,000 people are expected to be diagnosed with lung cancer this year. And historically, the five-year survival for patients diagnosed with advanced lung cancer is quite poor. To this date, it remains below about 15%. But we're starting to make strides in the treatment of advanced lung cancer, and advances became possible when it was recognized that lung cancer isn't just one or two diseases. Rather, it's a collection of histologically and molecularly distinct diseases. So contemporary therapies really build on this recognition. And therapy is based on the identification and targeting of oncogenic drivers. So if we look at lung cancer overall, it can be divided into small cell lung cancer and non-small cell lung cancer. This slide focuses on non-small cell lung cancer, which is really the focus of the work that is ongoing in my lab. If we look histologically at non-small cell lung cancer, you can see that it's divided into three subtypes: adenocarcinoma, which represents the largest subset, large cell carcinoma, and squamous cell carcinoma. Now, if you then sequence thousands of adenocarcinomas, you realize that it can be further subdivided based on oncogenic drivers, and that's represented in this lower pie chart at the bottom. Currently, about 40% of all lung adenocarcinomas do not yet have an oncogenic driver, but that means 60% of them do. And what we mean by oncogenic driver is a single mutation in an oncogene that fully supports the survival and proliferation of that type of cancer. So you can see the most frequently mutated gene in adenocarcinoma of the lung is KRAS. So 30% of lung cancers can be said to be KRAS dependent. 15% have mutations in the epidermal growth factor receptor gene, and that's going to be the focus of my presentation today. You can also see another common alteration involves the ALK tyrosine kinase in 5% of cancers and so on. What's important to note from this pie chart is that these mutations are largely mutually exclusive. That means there's only one driver per molecular subtype. And again, the tumor cells that have these mutations are addicted to those genes for their survival. And what that means therapeutically is that we can target them in the hopes of causing disease regression. The idea then in that you're going to match the type of mutation the tumor has to therapy, with the idea that drugs that target those oncogenic drivers are going to be selectively toxic to malignant cells. And the overall notion is that using these targeted therapies, they're going to be much better tolerated by patients than cytotoxic chemotherapy, which is much less specific, thereby providing a better treatment option for patients. Now, I want to point out, conceptually, this seems pretty straightforward. You identify the mutation, you give the patient the proper therapy. It's more complicated than that in reality in its implementation in the clinic for a variety of reasons. First of all, you have to have a robust biomarker assay. And the next presentation will consider the use of biomarkers in lung cancer. There also has to be a very rapid turnaround time. If you're talking about an advanced lung cancer patient, you can't wait 8 weeks, 10 weeks, 12 weeks to find out about the mutation. You also have to have a menu of targeted therapies available. So depending on what mutation you get, you're going to pick a different therapy that only works if you have a bunch of different therapies to offer the patient. And lastly, even if those therapies in reality exist, they have to be accessible to the patient. And what I'll show you on the next slide is that's not always the case. So what impact has precision medicine actually had in terms of lung cancer treatment? This is a very nice study that was run by Dr. Mark Chris, who just gave medical grand rounds last week, actually, here at Roswell Park. What he did was to take a set of patients, in this case, approximately 700 advanced lung cancer patients, and had them sequenced. All of these patients were identified as having a targetable lesion, so a lesion for which an existing molecularly targeted therapy could be applied. What you see is that about 300 of those patients, for one reason or another, did not actually get targeted therapy. Instead, they may have gotten a conventional cytotoxic therapy. The other 264 patients received a therapy that was matched to their oncogenic driver. The y-axis here is the median survival, and what's readily apparent is if you have an oncogenic driver and receive the appropriately molecular targeted therapy, you gain about a year in overall survival. So that's quite an impact in the setting of advanced lung cancer. So the particular oncogenic driver that we're going to focus on for the remainder of today's presentation is the epidermal growth factor receptor, or EGFR. This just shows you the structure of the EGFR protein. It has three essential domains, an extracellular domain. Can you guys actually see this pointer, or is it just in my imagination? Okay, so this may work better. So it has this extracellular domain, which is important both in binding ligand as well as mediating receptor dimerization. It has a transmembrane spanning domain that anchors it within the membrane, and it has this critical intracellular signaling domain, which is comprised of a tyrosine kinase domain and this C-terminal tail that can be phosphorylated at multiple tyrosine residues, and that serves as a docking platform for downstream signaling molecules. So what happens in the presence of a ligand, such as EGF, is EGF binds to that extracellular domain, and this causes a conformational change that allows the monomer to dimerize with another molecule of EGFR or an alternative HER family member protein, for example, such as HER2. The result of that is that the tyrosine kinase domain becomes activated and you get autophosphorylation of the C-terminal tails of the receptor, which then initiates downstream signaling through the AKT, STAT, and MEK signaling pathways, the activation of which promotes cell proliferation as well as cell survival. What happens in EGFR mutant lung cancer is that the tyrosine kinase domain actually becomes hyperactivated due to the presence of distinct mutations. The most commonly observed mutations are this L858R point mutation in exon 21, which is within the tyrosine kinase domain, as well as the exon 19 deletion, which is located in close proximity to the ATP binding site within the tyrosine kinase domain. And what these mutations do is to stabilize the activated conformation of the receptor, thereby allowing for essentially constitutive activation of the receptor, even in the absence of ligand. Again, this occurs in about 15% of all lung adenocarcinomas that are diagnosed within the United States, but upwards of 50 or 60% of lung adenocarcinomas that are identified in Asian populations. Now, we know that this mutated receptor is sufficient to drive lung tumors because it's been engineered into mouse models. And in those mouse models, the L858R mutation or the exon 19 deletion is adequate to drive the formation of lung tumors. And when you stop its expression, the lung tumors regress. Therefore, we know these cells are addicted to EGFR signaling. Now, based on this fact, one could argue, therefore, that it's reasonable to inhibit the EGFR in order to cause regression of this type of tumor. And in fact, that's exactly what happens. The key class of molecules that are involved in the therapy of advanced EGFR mutant lung tumors are EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. The one that is used most commonly in the clinic in the United States is erlotinib, which has received FDA approval for the first-line therapy of patients who have those oncogenic mutations in the EGFR. So what's important to note about erlotinib is that it's a first-generation inhibitor, and it works by binding reversibly within that tyrosine kinase domain of the receptor. It essentially outcompetes ATP. And when it was tested in patients who have EGFR gene mutations, there's a very high rate of initial response. Almost 70% of patients will respond to treatment, and they get a benefit from treatment for about a year, after which time drug resistance develops and the therapy stops working. And there's been a lot of effort put into understanding what causes drug resistance. And the majority of it has been attributed to the presence of this second site mutation in the tyrosine kinase domain, the so-called gatekeeper mutation at residue 790, so it converts a threonine to a methionine, the consequence of which now ATP binds better within the tyrosine kinase domain, so ATP outcompetes erlotinib. So the end consequence is that erlotinib becomes less effective. So you can imagine the pharmaceutical industry jumped on this observation and worked to develop tyrosine kinase inhibitors that will bind to T790M mutant EGFR. And the most clinically successful of these inhibitors is osimertinib. So osimertinib is a third generation, very contemporary EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Unlike erlotinib, osimertinib is an irreversible inhibitor, so it makes a covalent association within the ATP binding pocket of the EGFR. And also, quite importantly, osimertinib is wild-type sparing. This means that all your cells that have wild-type EGFRs do not bind this drug. Therefore, its toxicity profile is better. And what was quite remarkable, when osimertinib was tested in clinical trials, it was used after first-line failure, for example, of erlotinib. And despite that fact, the response rate was remarkably high, 70%, and even some patients who had failed erlotinib actually experienced a complete response when treating with osimertinib. And these responses were durable, again, lasting almost another year. So based on these early results, osimertinib received FDA approval for use after erlotinib therapy only in patients who have the T790M gatekeeper mutation. So right now, this is the best therapy for patients who have a T790M mutation, but unfortunately, just like erlotinib, patients will eventually fail this therapy, and we're only now beginning to understand the variety of mechanisms by which that might occur. So my lab was interested in working to develop therapies that could be used to prevent or overcome osimertinib therapy. And we really became interested in utilizing vitamin D in this context. So you ask yourself, where on earth would you come up with that idea? And really, the epidemiology pointed us in the direction of looking at vitamin D in EGFR mutant lung cancer. So there were a lot of preclinical as well as epidemiologic studies that suggested that vitamin D metabolites could prevent the development of lung cancer. But there was much more variability in the epidemiologic studies that tried to link vitamin D to lung cancer survival. But what was quite notable to us was a study that was published in 2012 by Dr. Cheng, who's now on the faculty here in cancer prevention and pathology. And what he discovered while a postdoctoral associate was that while there was no overall association between circulating vitamin D levels and death from lung cancer, lifetime never smokers who developed lung cancer were significantly less likely to die from their disease if they had high vitamin D levels. What's important to note here is that lifetime never smokers are a demographic that enriches for EGFR gene mutations. So this suggested to us that this EGFR mutant subset of lung cancers might be a subset where we could find some vitamin D activity. So we asked ourselves, Might lung cancers that develop in never smokers be preferentially affected by vitamin D metabolites? So before I start to show you some of the data from our lab, I need to give you just a little bit of background about what we know about vitamin D metabolism and signaling in cancer cells. So where does vitamin D come from?
The sun.
The sun or your diet, right? Okay, so either in response to sunlight exposure, you can produce vitamin D in your skin from its precursor 7-dehydrocholesterol. Alternatively, you can go to GNC or Wegmans and buy yourself some vitamin D. Then vitamin D is acted on by your liver to produce the primary circulating metabolite, 25-hydroxyvitamin D. So when you go to your doctor's office and they measure your vitamin D status, this is the metabolite that's being measured. 25-hydroxyvitamin D is then acted on by your kidney to produce the active metabolite, 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D. 1,25-D binds to the vitamin D receptor, which heterodimerizes with the retinoid X receptor. This is an active transcription factor, which at vitamin D response elements will induce or regulate target gene transcription. And the processes that are affected by vitamin D include differentiation, proliferation, growth factor signaling, all kinds of things that are important in controlling the growth of cancers. So it's reasonable based on these data to anticipate that vitamin D metabolites could have anti-proliferative activity. So before I show you a few slides highlighting data from our laboratory, I first wanted to acknowledge the people who have actually done the work. Alyssa Verone was a PhD student in my lab who's now working at Athenex, and Tatiana Shirova is a current PhD student in my laboratory who hopefully will be graduating soon. So I'm going to be showing you their data, and they were assisted by my lab manager, Sue Shoemaker. So we first asked ourselves, are tumor cells that have EGFR mutations vulnerable to the effects of vitamin D? And for these studies, we used the active metabolite, 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D. So we assembled a panel of lung cancer cell lines that we had either EGFR gene mutations, KRAS mutations, or dual mutations in KRAS and the tumor suppressor STK11. We then measured vitamin D receptor levels in Western blot experiments, knowing that you require the BDR in order to be responsive to vitamin D. And what you can see is the EGFR mutants cell lines had BDR present in contrast to the KRAS STK11 mutants, which universally lacked or had very low expression of the BDR. We then tested the ability of the cells to mount a transcriptional response to vitamin D, and you can see that the HCC827 cell line that has an EGFR mutation mounted a transcriptional response to vitamin D, whereas the KRAS STK11 mutant A549 cell line did not. The ability to mount a transcriptional response also correlated with vulnerability to vitamin D-mediated growth inhibition, where the EGFR mutant cell line showed nice dose-dependent growth inhibition and the KRAS STK11 mutant cell line did not. So this tells us that EGFR mutants are preferentially vulnerable, at least in vitro, to the anti-proliferative effects of vitamin D. Now, these are cell lines, and who knows if EGFR mutant lung cancers in people actually have BDR. So in order to ask this question, we went back to the Pathology Resource Network here at Roswell Park, and we pulled out every case of non-smoking lung cancer that we could find. Why did we do that? What did I tell you about non-smoking lung cancers? They enrich for EGFR gene mutations, okay? So we then, though, that enriches for them, it doesn't tell you they have them. So we then had to sequence those tumors, and we found 18 cases of EGFR mutant lung cancer. We stained them for VDR, and 18 out of 18 of them had at least some VDR. So that tells us then that the receptor is present, and therefore these tumors might respond to vitamin D. We then went on to test whether we could demonstrate growth inhibition by vitamin D metabolites in the xenograft model. So here we used the HCC827 cell line that has one of those oncogenic EGFR mutations. We made the 10 mice vitamin D deficient by feeding them a diet low in vitamin D. 10 mice received a vitamin D deficient diet until we implanted the tumor cells, and then they were switched to a vitamin D supplemented diet, and 10 mice received the supplemented diet for the whole duration of the experiment, and then we monitored tumor outgrowth, And what you can see from these data is the vitamin D deficient mice, the tumors grew significantly more rapidly than the vitamin D replete mice. Moreover, if the mice were vitamin D deficient at the time the tumor cells were implanted and we switched to a replete diet, we could also slow down the growth of the tumors. To the best of our knowledge, these are the first data to actually show that vitamin D can control the growth of a specific molecular subset of lung cancer, those with EGFR gene mutations. Now, I told you that EGFR mutant lung cancers clinically get treated with TKIs. And if we wanted to take this data into the clinic, we would have to do so in the context of a TKI therapy, most likely osimertinib, because right now that's kind of the last line of effective therapy for these patients. So in order to begin to test the effects of vitamin D, we actually generated an osimertinib-resistant cell line by growing these H1975 cells that have a T790M mutation and are sensitive to osimertinib in 500 nanomolar drug until drug resistance develops. And you can see in these dose response curves here to the right that we shifted the response to osimertinib rightward in our resistant cell line about 50-fold. So what we wanted to do then, using these osimertinib resistant cells, is say, how did they become resistant? In resistant cells, do they still have a vitamin D receptor? And could that vitamin D be used to overcome drug resistance? So we tested a lot of different mechanisms by which these cells might become resistant, and I'm only showing you the positive results here. If you focus first on this panel, we were looking at the expression of E-cadherin, which is an important biomarker for the epithelial mesenchymal transition. What you will see is that the parental cell line has high levels of E-cadherin, is therefore epithelial, whereas the resistant cell line loses E-cadherin mRNA as well as protein expression. So these cells have undergone an EMT. And that's important because we know from the literature that EMT is a mechanism of resistance to earlier generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors. We also looked at the activation state of all those signaling molecules that are downstream of the EGFR. And here what you will note is in the osimertinib resistant cells, phosphorylation of STAT3 was much higher than it was in the parental cells, and STAT3 could not be suppressed in the presence of osimertinib. And this is important because STAT3 has been shown to be a mechanism, a clinically relevant mechanism of resistance to tyrosine kinase inhibitors as well. So we believe in these cells, but they have undergone an EMT and have elevated levels of STAT3 that are protecting them against osimertinib. So do they still have a vitamin D receptor that we could exploit during treatment? Here are the vitamin D receptor levels in the parental cell line and the osimertinib resistant cell line, and you can see that the levels are pretty comparable, so that's a good sign. That means potentially the receptor can signal. We then measured two different vitamin D target genes, CYP24A1 and cathelicidin, in our parental cells and our osimertinib resistant cells. And you can see that when we treated these cells with vitamin D, we induced both target genes to levels that were comparable to the parental cell. So we lost no vitamin D signaling capacity during the development of osimertinib resistance. Okay, that's a good sign. Can vitamin D do anything to that EMT phenotype or phospho-STAT3 that might be beneficial? Here was the remarkable result. For us, it was a remarkable result. If you look here at E-cadherin expression in the osimertinib resistant cells, it was very low. When we treated with vitamin D, E-cadherin was dramatically induced. You see that at the RNA level as well as the protein level. In our osimertinib resistant cells, the EMT transcription factor SNAIL was high. Vitamin D repressed it. Vitamin D also repressed it at the protein level. And in addition, Vimentin here, you can see when we treated with vitamin D in combination with osimertinib, Vimentin was suppressed. This is another marker of the EMT, suggesting that we've pushed these cells back towards being epithelial. And now if you look in this upper right corner, you would see STAT3 was completely suppressed when we co-treated cells with vitamin D plus osimertinib. So it looked at the molecular level like we were able to reverse the resistance mechanisms using vitamin D. Well, that's the molecular level. What happens to actual growth? Here are the results of those growth experiments. These are our vehicle-treated cells, resistant cells, vitamin D-treated cells. Vitamin D alone does nothing to growth. Osimertinib alone does nothing to growth. You combine them, and now you significantly and dramatically suppress growth of these drug-resistant cells. And when we did a dose-response experiment, we were able to reshift the dose response to osimertinib all the way back to the low nanomolar concentrations that are seen in the parental drug-sensitive cell line. So at least in this one model, vitamin D seems to be able to actually work to reverse osimertinib resistance. This would give patients a great opportunity to continue to benefit from osimertinib therapy. Now, this is all in vitro. What about in vivo? Well, that's where we are. I'm going to skip that for a second. That's where we're working right now. We didn't want to study lung cancer in the subcutaneous xenograft model because lung tumors actually grow in the lungs. So we had to develop an orthotopic model. To do that, we used ultrasound-guided imaging to implant either the parental cells or the osimertinib resistant cells directly into the lungs. We then used magnetic resonance imaging to monitor the outgrowth of these cells. Once we knew the tumors were growing, we started treating with osimertinib. And you can see the parental cells shown here shrink when you treat with osimertinib within 1 week. This becomes very evident. Whereas the osimertinib resistant cells, The osimertinib resistant cells continue to grow. And that's shown graphically here. So we now have a model in which we can test the ability of modulating dietary vitamin D metabolites to change the growth of these drug-resistant cells. And that's where we are. Literally, those experiments are ongoing right now. In terms of how we think vitamin D is working, it's known that cells in the presence of tyrosine kinase inhibitors start to produce IL-6. The IL-6 combines with the IL-6 receptor to activate STAT3 independent of the EGFR. We know from other studies that we've done in the lab that vitamin D can repress IL-6 production. Vitamin D may also be working to block the activation of STAT3 by JAK. In addition, vitamin D can directly activate EK adherin to overcome the EMT. So we think vitamin D can act as a multi-level repressor of this bypass signaling pathway that contributes to osimertinib resistance. Okay? So I was told I have 30 minutes. That was exactly 30 minutes. Do you have any questions? Yes.
Some experiments you show have another cell line have more vitamin D receptor than the EGFR cell line.
Yes. So this, for example, this H292 cell line, H292 has a wild-type EGFR. It also has a wild-type KRAS. So among all the cell lines that we've tested, it's the most normal, if you buy that. It is actually also remarkably sensitive to vitamin D, both in vitro and in vivo. Yeah. So that's a really important point that you're making. So I've focused on EGFR. But the reality is there may also be other molecular subsets that are sensitive, and that's one of the other things we're very interested in pursuing in the lab. Conversely, I would make the argument our data, as well as others, strongly supports not bothering with vitamin D in these KRAS STK11 mutants because three different labs have shown that vitamin D has no activity in these cells. So I think EGFR represents the minimal subset that we can expect to be responsive. Great question. Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon. So this lecture, actually, current topics in lung cancer research, as you can surmise, it's a very, very complex topic to cover because there's so many aspects to it, and many of them require a deeper understanding of the biological basis or the technological reasonings behind particular types of research. So what I've tried to do here in my section of the lecture, which covers mutations and biomarkers, is kind of give you an overview about these aspects of cancer research. So much of the information that you will get actually applies to other types of cancer. And then I also try to provide some examples of relatively recent work on mutations and biomarkers with respect to lung cancer. So just to give you an idea of what kind of research is actively going on in these topics. So When I say mutations, what I really mean is genomic variations. So by mutations or genomic variations, we can imply many different things. So obviously the simplest concept or idea that comes to mind by mutation is single nucleotide base change, which is also referred to as single nucleotide variation or single nucleotide polymorphism. And then you can have larger, longer nucleotide changes. So you can have, for example, microsatellites, mini-satellites, indels, and so forth. And then there can be even bigger kilobase or megabase size changes, which can include things like chromosomal deletions or inversions, complete losses, gains of chromosomes, or movement of different segments of chromosomes from one chromosome to another. And so the nomenclature which is used to describe these genomic variations is still not standardized, so you can have different people referring to the same things in different ways. So some people can refer to amplification or deletion, which is basically gain or loss of a gene, as copy number variation, for example. Similarly, you can have microscopic movement of genetic regions referred to as fusions, for example, where you have two different genes coming next to each other, for and creating a fusion gene. So this is just to give you an idea of all the types of different mutations or genomic variations that occur in cancer. Some of these are easier to study, some of them are more difficult to study. For example, the larger scale chromosomal scale genomic variations are easy to detect even microscopically. On the other hand, for single nucleotide level resolution level of detection of genomic variation, you need techniques like sequencing. So what causes this mutation? So I'm not sure if you had previous lectures on this topic on mutational processes in cancer, but the important thing to remember is that there is no single process which causes mutation in cancer. There can be multiple processes which occur as the cancer progresses. Furthermore, these processes can occur at different time periods. So you may have, for example, as illustrated here, you may have a process one which occurs early in the cancer, and as the cancer evolves, that process declines in intensity, and two or three other processes start happening. So the final mutations that you see in a cancer at a particular time reflects all these different mutational processes which have occurred in the past in the cancer. So some of these processes can be constant. They could be the intensity, whether they're strong or weak, can vary. They can also be intermittent. For example, a process may occur only during a certain period of time, and it may disappear. And so currently, we don't have a clear understanding of all the types of mutational processes that occur in a cancer, but we are getting towards it. So this is something to keep in mind when we think about mutations and how it affects biology of cancer. So as you know, lung cancer, both adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma types of lung cancer, are characterized by higher mutational burden compared to other cancers. So this is an illustration from our 2013 paper where they examined the mutation burden of the mutation landscape in 12 major cancers. So this includes the lung adenocarcinoma and lung squamous cell carcinoma, and also other cancers, acute myeloid leukemia, cervical, uterine, endometrial cancer, colorectal cancer, and so forth. You can see that both adeno and squamous cell carcinoma are characterized by a very high number of mutations per million bases of the genome, roughly to 15 or 20 or so mutations per megabase. On the other hand, something like AML is characterized by a much smaller number of mutations. It's interesting that uterine endometrial carcinoma also can have very high mutational burden. The other interesting thing that one can glean for these large-scale projects is that certain type of mutations, here we are talking about single nucleotide variations or single base change type of mutations, you can see that different cancers have different types of base changes. So if you look at the C2T, the light blue here, type of changes, you can you'll find that in some cancers like breast cancer and leukemia, these type of changes are much more prevalent. than the others. On the other hand, in adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma, you find there are more of C2A type of changes, which are transgressions where you change from pyrimidine to purine or vice versa kind of nucleotide. So these research findings which are coming from these large-scale projects are providing us an idea about specific type of mutations, the characteristics of mutations that occur in cancers. And so one of the things that has emerged is that you can actually identify signatures of mutations. So by mutation signature, we mean a particular sequence context in which a mutation occurs. So let's say in a particular cancer, in a particular genome location, you have a C2G kind of change or mutation. This C2G change can occur in a particular motif. For example, a C might be followed by a G residue, and it can be preceded by any of the four nucleotide bases and so forth. So you can identify these signatures in cancers, and people have been recently doing that, and they find that some cancers are enriched for particular type of signatures. And so the belief now is that these signatures reflect particular mutational processes. So how a cancer evolves, how different cancers evolve, etc., can be understood by examining the mutational signature. So this is again a paper from 2013 where they have tried to check which signatures are enriched in different types of cancer. So signature 1A or signature 1B, which affect a particular sequence context in which mutations occur, are seen in cancers across all types largely, and it's believed that these signatures reflect age-related mutational processes. On the other hand, you have signature 4, which is believed to be a smoking-related mutational process, and you see it enriched in cancers which are associated with smoking, like lung cancer. So one other interesting thing that this kind of analysis is providing is that certain protein or gene families themselves have been associated with mutational processes. So one of them is an APOBAC family of proteins. I'll talk about them later. So some cancers, especially bladder and breast cancer, have signature mutations which indicate that the cell's own proteins are causing mutations in the genomes. So these large-scale projects like the Cancer Genome Atlas project, whose data is shown here, have identified the types of genes or the genes which are mutated more frequently in different types of cancer. So this is a representation of data that we now have for common genes which are mutated in adenocarcinoma. And as Pamela referred to, it includes the EGFR gene and of course genes like TP53, which are known to be mutated in a very large number of cancers. And the interesting thing is that the mutation pattern varies slightly between males and females, and there are also some differences between smokers, ever smokers, and people who have never smoked. The same thing has been done for squamous cell carcinoma. Again, we find the P53 gene is mutated in a large number, 81% in this study of squamous cell carcinoma of lung cancer cases. On the other hand, mutations of genes like KRAS, EGFR are much less frequent in squamous cell carcinoma. So again, these are single nucleotide variation type of mutations or indel type of mutations. They don't include data on gene fusion. So EML4, so the EML-ALP4 fusion, for example, is not included here. That fusion is commonly seen in squamous cell carcinoma. So there is now some good amount of information on common mutations, copy number variations, etc., and this is summarized in this table. This table also includes information on the small cell type of lung cancer. Again, P53 gene mutation is common in small cell type of lung cancer also, but you don't see mutations in EGFR, KRAS, etc., as commonly in small cell. Then in terms of copy number variations, basically amplifications or losses of genes, particular genes such as the NKX2-1 is highly associated with copy gains in adenocarcinoma. On the other hand, you don't see this gene getting copy gained in squamous cell carcinoma. And these different genes affect different molecular pathways, so providing an insight on how what exactly is happening in these cells at the molecular level and what's driving the growth, resistance to treatment, etc. So you can kind of guess what are the reasons why these mutations are being studied. So just to summarize, they provide us an understanding of cancer biology, they help accurately subclassify cancer, they help us identify specific proteins or pathways for drug treatment. These mutations are made as referred to as actionable mutations. And then you can design precise treatment for a particular individual using this information for mutation. Finally, we can use mutation information as biomarkers for lung cancer specific questions. So some of the examples for these reasons. So this is a recent study just published which indicates that the two types of common types of lung cancer, adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma, may actually be maybe six different subtypes of adenocarcinoma and three different subtypes of squamous cell carcinoma. And in this particular case, they look at over 1,000 cases, and they combine information on mutations as well as gene expression to come up with this subclassification of cancer. And the idea here is that maybe by being able to subclassify cancers, you can design or use particular therapies for particular subtypes of cancer. So again, you can see, like, if you were to look at common genes which are associated with the two subtypes, the two adeno and squamous types of cancer, there are really two types. One may say squamous and adeno. On the other hand, if you increase the number of genes that you're looking at, look at more genes, in this case 700 genes, you can see that within this uniform looking profile, you can have some further subtypes, and they can be associated with particular mutations. For example, the squamous 2A and 2B have more of the amplification for the SOX2 gene compared to squamous type 1 and so forth. Again, these are studies in progress. It's not like absolute truth. So these are the directions people are taking the mutation information. This is an example of a study where one group was able to design a very precise treatment for a particular case of lung cancer. In this case, the patient was a 50-year-old woman who had secondary cylindrical lung. So these are secondary lung tumors. The primary tumor was a colorectal cancer. So this patient had seven tumors, and by sequencing these tumors, they were able to identify, the group identified about 70 genes which were mutated, and one of the genes was the KRAS gene. Particularly, it had this G12D amino acid change type of mutation with about 27% frequency. So what they did was they biopsied these tumor lesions, isolated CD8 plus T cells, and then expanded these T cells in vitro to identify KRAS mutation reactive T cells. And after they expand these T cells, they injected back into the patients. So by sequencing a particular mutation, identify patients' own T cells which can target this mutation and inject it back, and they were able to get complete regression or almost complete regression of all these seven secondaries by 9 months. So this is again an example of use of mutation data which people are getting into. Finally, this is an example where mutation data is being used to understand cancer biology. So one of the things that people are getting into now is multi-region sequencing. So instead of sequencing just one biopsy of lung cancer, they are sequencing multiple regions. And what that does is it provides an idea on how the tumor has evolved. So maybe the R2, this particular region of the tumor, appeared later as a clone, compared to this region which may have appeared earlier as a separate clone, so forth. So by sequencing different regions and looking at the mutations in them, you can get an idea of the evolutionary tree of the cancer evolution. So as in this hypothetical example, you can have region 1 and 2 evolving later, and they may have a PIK3C gene mutation which is not there in different clones of the same tumor. And Then by further looking at signatures within these mutations, within these different regions, you can come to other insights. For example, one might find that in the early clones of the tumor, the early generation of the tumor, you have more of a C2A type of mutation, which indicates association with smoking. On the other hand, in the later clones, you may have more of a C2T type of mutation, which indicates an APOBAC-mediated mutational process. So as I mentioned, APOBACs are this family of cytidine deaminase enzymes. So they are able to act on DNA, and they will deaminate C residues, cytidine residues in DNA, converting them into uracil or basically a T residue. So they result in a C2T type of mutation. So by looking at enhancement of C2T type of mutation, you can kind of associate them with the APOBAC family of proteins. So this idea was used in a paper in 2014, where they looked at early mutations and late mutations and came to the conclusion that the APOBAC-mediated mutation process occurs later in a tumor, and it occurs even if a lung cancer patient had stopped smoking many years ago. On the other hand, the smoking-associated signature, the C2A type of mutation, occurs early on, and it gets reduced in intensity after smoking cessation. So the idea that, you know, if you stop smoking, you can revert your chances of getting cancer is partly true, but this indicates that some of the damage remains. So it appears that smoking can ultimately lead to enhancement of this APOBAC-mediated mutation process. And so even though smoking has been stopped later, this mutation process continues. So that's all. These are the slides that I had about mutations. I'm going to shift to biomarkers. So these are just a few slides here. Again, this is a very vast topic. When we talk of biomarkers, what we really mean is information which mark a particular biological state. So this information, this biological state marking, the purpose may be as a diagnostic tool, for example, to see if somebody has lung cancer. Could be used for prognostication to see, for example, what chances the patient has for relapse of cancer after surgery. And obviously, this diagnostic or prognostic purpose has to be specific. It has to have good sensitivity. Biomarkers can have different types of analytes. They can be protein-based, they can be gene-based, RNA-based, etc. But they can also be based on small molecules, as simple as, for example, a hormone. And they can also involve looking at multiple analytes. So instead of looking at one RNA, the biomarker might be an aggregate value of multiple gene expression or mRNA values. Obviously, how that biomarker is measured is important, how sensitive that method is, how specific that is also comes into play. Then one has to think of what kind of sample one is looking at. Is it, for example, the diseased material itself, such as resected tumor tissue or biopsy of a tumor tissue, or is it material which is indirectly affected by the disease process, for example, white blood cells in the blood, or it could be also indirectly affected material in the sense that tumor cells which have now moved away from the location are floating in the blood. Then one has to consider other things like sample acquisition. Does it involve invasiveness? Do you have to actually go into the tumor to obtain it? Is it non-invasive? Are you looking at things like blood, urine, which are easy to obtain? So again, there are thousands of biomarkers for many different persons on which studies have been published. And they, as I mentioned, they involve all kinds of analytes, including things like methylation of genes, RNAs, microRNAs, and so forth. So I'm just pointing two, three very simple examples to give you an idea. So this is a study from 2008 looking at microRNA-based biomarkers. The purpose of this biomarker was prediction of recurrence and survival in non-small cell lung cancer. So after treatment of lung cancer by surgery, how long it takes for recurrence to occur or the patient to die, and can you use microRNAs in the tumor itself to measure that or predict that. So in this case, as usual with biomarker development, you usually use a training data set for these are samples for which you know what happened to this patient, whether they had recurrence or not, did not have recurrence, and use that to train your microRNA data. And then use that information to test the biomarker against a new set of patients. And in this particular study, they also had a second independent testing data set. This is another microRNA-based biomarker. In this case, instead of looking at tumor microRNAs, they're looking at serum microRNAs. So the idea is that microRNAs are present in circulation in the blood, in plasma or serum, and they can reflect a particular disease process. In this case, they want to see if they can reflect presence of lung cancer in people who smoke. So here, they are looking at 34 microRNAs. So this is a multiple analyte kind of biomarker test with a sample of serum, and they use RT-PCR to measure it. So in this study, this is data from their test set, and so they have smokers who did not have lung cancer or smokers who had lung cancer. As control, the smokers who did not have lung cancer may have had chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or a non-cancerous nodule or pneumonia, and the authors of this study claim that they are able to identify with good probability what they're calling risk presence of lung cancer in these, and whether it's an adenocarcinoma type of lung cancer or squamous cell type of lung cancer compared to the benign type of disease conditions. So again, most of these biomarkers are not really in clinical practice, except for, so there are very few, a number of biomarker-based tests which are in clinical practice. So this is another example of a research kind of biomarker. Here the research group is looking at volatile organic compounds in the breath, so they're taking exhaled breath and using mass spectrometry and gas chromatography to identify different volatile organic compounds, and they claim that they can distinguish lung cancer and healthy controls based on the profile of their organic compounds in the breath. Again, this is not in clinical practice, this is a research topic, but there are some biomarkers which are clinically used. Pam already referred to the EGFR gene mutation biomarker. Then there are biomarkers which are based on mutations in KRAS, MET, ALK gene, etc., which are used for other squamous cell carcinoma or other types of non-squamous cell cancer. So finally, the last topic I will cover in biomarkers is about circulating DNA. This is a relatively new area of interest. So by circulating DNA, some people refer to it as cell-free DNA. We are talking about DNA which is free-floating in the blood. So these DNAs came into picture recently. In fact, they were identified in pregnant women who were examined for fetal DNA in circulation. And also the advent of sequencing technologies has helped with these studies. So in the blood, you can have circulating DNA which arises from cells which are undergoing necrosis or apoptosis. And obviously, if you have tumor cells, you can have more of this necrosis apoptotic process going on. And during these biological processes, you have DNA which gets released into the circulation. So the circulation will have DNA from normal cells, from tumor cells, or other types of disease cells. And the idea here is to detect the tumor cell DNA. So the difference between the tumor cell DNA and the normal cell DNA is really the mutation in the tumor cell DNA. So if we can detect DNA in blood which carries a particular mutation, for example an EGFR mutation, then you can use that to mark presence of cancer or whether the cancer is growing in size, whether it has come back after treatment and so forth. But the problem with using circulating DNA is that the amount of cell-free DNA in circulation is very small. It's only about 50 nanograms in a milliliter of plasma, which is about 50 nanograms, let's say in about 2 or 3 milliliters of blood. And that affects 10,000 genome DNA copies. So if each DNA has two copies of a gene, this means that you really have to have a high percentage of mutated DNA in the blood to be able to detect it. So on top of the background coming from the normal genome DNA, being able to pick up this mutated DNA is very difficult. then it also gets complicated because circulating DNA has a short half-life. Anyway, people have been using this, and there's been quite a bit of excitement about it. There's a new paper in Nature, which I suggested as an assigned reading for this course. And if you have time, you can go through it and you can see how complex the work is. But the authors are able to show useful value to the circulating human DNA. So in this particular case, they are using this study, which was conducted in England. They looked at 100 patients. These 100 patients come from a larger study, which is going on there, the TRACERx study. So here they have 100 patients who are diagnosed with non-small cell lung cancer, and after these patients are treated with surgery and with adjuvant chemotherapy or radiotherapy, they're followed up for up to 5 years, during which time their blood is collected also, and they isolate plasma from this blood to look at circulating DNA. And the idea here is that different patients have different mutations, and you can design PCR-based methods. So in this particular case, PCR followed by sequencing to look for mutations. So the goal being to make the detection of circulating DNA, which is already present in very low amount, make it more sensitive and be able to pick up the very small portion of mutant DNA which is there in that circulating DNA. And so they use a PCR-based method to look at this circulating DNA isolated from the blood, and then use that to see if they can associate it with recurrence of cancer. And there are some interesting findings in this study. One very interesting thing is that with adenocarcinoma type of lung cancer, detection of circulating DNA is poor. So only about 20% of cases they are able to detect circulating tumor DNA. On the other hand, in squamous cell type of cancer, in almost all cases they are able to detect circulating tumor DNA. So their hypothesis is that detection of circulating tumor DNA is associated with necrosis. So the more necrosis you have going on in the samples, the easier it is to pick up circulating tumor DNA. And but in those cases in which they are able to pick up circulating tumor DNA, they find that they can indeed associate it with relapse of cancer. This is an example of adenocarcinoma where circulating tumor DNA was detected during or before surgery, just before surgery, and following surgery along these 20 days. As time progressed, the amount of circulating DNA decreased, especially following chemotherapy and radiotherapy, and circulating tumor DNA never came back, was never detected after 200 days. And this coincided with no detection of relapse in these patients. On the other hand, this is the case of squamous cell carcinoma, where they had circulating DNA, tumor DNA detected before surgery. Following surgery, it disappeared, but over time, it reappeared. And in fact, they could see it 77 days before detection of relapse by radiological techniques. So this paper suggests that with sensitive methods, one may be able to use circulating tumor DNA to pick up lung cancer, such as the presence of lung cancer or recurrence following treatment, much earlier than you can with currently available clinical techniques. So that's all I have for my section. If you have any questions, please call me or email me, or you can visit me in my office. Thank you.
I don't know if you need to stand up and move around or stretch. This is definitely the home stretch. My name is Mary Reed. I'm a cancer epidemiologist. So I actually approach the lung cancer, especially premalignant lesions, from the human side first. And so feel free to interrupt and ask any questions. So the TCGA is it's kind of a name taken off of the TCGA, which is the Premalignant Cancer Genome Atlas. And this is an abstract, a talk that was presented at AACR by a group that I work with from Boston University, Jennifer Bean, and majority of the people up front. And then myself and Samjat Dhillon, who are from Roswell Park, to look at in pre-malignant squamous cell lung carcinoma lesions to come up with distinct molecular subtypes associated with histologic progression. It's kind of a long title, but so I know you had a great introduction of the whole lung cancer thing with Todd Demme last week. And my emphasis with lung cancer, my emphasis with cancer, you know, started with looking at colorectal polyps, and that was, you know, in the that was what my dissertation was on. And I transitioned to lung, and I was continued to be interested in what happens before cancer. And there's a couple reasons. You know, only 1 in 9 smokers gets lung cancers. And that is really dictated by exposure. But the problem with where we are right now in actually characterizing what smoking, you know, does to the airway is that we really don't have a signature that differentiates who's at risk and who isn't. We know that half of lung cancer cases are among former smokers. So we know there's a persistent damage which they do not repair. And again, we don't know how to differentiate between the former smokers who quit for 20 years and their risk goes down, never to normal, and the 20-year former smoker like Peter Jennings who gets lung cancer and dies in 3 months. And they tend to have very aggressive tumors. And so having this molecular signature for the way I look at lung cancer is very important. You know, there is a growing number of people who never smoked who get lung cancer. Many of them have the EGFR mutation, and that's kind of where PAM has put a lot of energy. We know that, you know, there's certain risk factors for that, like, you know, Asian descent. But there's something else that pushes those lung cancers. And while that's interesting, the big elephant in the room is smoking. We still have almost 20% of adults who smoke. In some countries like Cuba, 80% of adult men smoke. And so I'm really interested in that. It's kind of like the politically incorrect cancer, but, you know, it kills a lot of people, kills more women than breast cancer. And so I really think that if we could start to map out what happens in the early genome of transition from just being a smoke-exposed lung to cancer, it would be really beneficial. And I'm not obviously not alone, and I didn't, you know, come up with this idea all on my own. The one thing that we know with lung cancer screening, and I could talk for hours on that, is that the current distribution of lung cancers is here, that the majority of them are diagnosed late. We don't offer surgery to these people. There's no cure for the most part. We're trying to control their tumor. Very seldom do any treatments really make those tumors disappear. With lung cancer screening, this is where the majority of cancers will be picked up, in the early stage where you can have curative surgery and you can have adjuvant treatment or neoadjuvant treatment and really make a difference. And again, I want to focus on those because as this happens over the course, we will get a lot more information about cancers. Right now, these are the only, you know, really, you get surgery here. You may get surgery if you have a very discrete tumor here, but the information that we know about lung cancer is really limited to these early lesions. And now we should, according to, you know, estimates, get 70% of cancers so that we'll have a lot of material. So we know that before, for squamous cell, for example, which is, when we talk about endoscopic or bronchoscopic lesions, we are so focused on the central airway because that's as far as the bronch can really go. There's a few new things, I think maybe Todd mentioned them about, navigational bronch that sticks very fine filaments into the periphery of the lung. But we're really looking at squamous cell. Now, the majority of lung cancers are adenocarcinomas, and they're in the periphery. So what does this central airway squamous cell tell us? And, you know, my colleagues view this as sort of being, what is the damage to the field? I mean, the chance that they're going to develop a central airway tumor are low. 2/3 are going to be peripheral adenos. But if you can access some tissue that got smoke exposed and figure out what some of the genetic signatures are like, then in any smoker, you could go in and scrape the lung and see if they're the ones at risk. And, you know, hopefully someday we'll be able to scrape the nose and know if they're at risk or draw a blood sample. So in early cancer in of the squamous epithelium, this is the model of progression. We know that histologically you see this transition from normal through squamous metaplasia, several grades of dysplasia to carcinoma in situ. The majority of these lesions do not progress. I mean, profoundly the majority, but there is a subset in the airway of premalignant lesions that has a signature, and that's what we've been getting at. And this work has been going on for a long time, but since 2000 or slightly before, we really started to work on this signature. So from the bronch side, this is a normal airway, and that's what normal squamous epithelium looks like. Very ordered. There's the cilia. There's a distinct basal membrane. This is still, this is one of our slides, so we know this was still in a smoker. They still have a lot of normal airway. These are infiltrating, immune cells into the stromal layer, which communicate things which also tell you that they had a lot of inflammation going on. This is under autofluorescence, this is a different wavelength light. We have this device here at Roswell. We've used it for the past 15 years to pick up premalignant lesions. And this is what a carcinoma in situ looks like. And under fluorescence, you can see these reddened zones, which means that the epithelium is thickened. Under white light, this might look normal. Even this airway in a smoker, you can see that it's kind of mottled. It's not nice and smooth necessarily. So there is still damage, but we can see a squamous a carcinoma in situ when we inspect the airway. And this is just a couple examples. This is under white light. So again, this is the lesion, and we would biopsy that, and we'd get probably a moderate to severe dysplasia. This is a more advanced carcinoma in situ. I'm just going to show you some pictures so that you can see that in the normal airway, so this is normal, and these are blood vessels, and you still have some, not as so much inflammation and not so much, dysmorphia in terms of damage. Here's a hyperplasia, squamous metaplasia. So this kind of thickening, which is, if we stain these for measures of proliferation, they stain heavily here because these are the new cells they're pushing out to thicken this epithelium, and you can see there's a lot more immune cell invasion along the basal layer. Things are starting to get irregular. There's a loss of cilia, which means in this kind of person, they have a problem with expelling sputum. So again, I am the person, I start with the human, on the human side. So what we've been doing for a number of years, and this is where the collaboration between a researcher and a clinician happened, is I've been very lucky to work with Samjath. Because when he does the actual sticking of the tube down the airway, we've collaborated on what samples to collect. So here we have a couple lesions in the lung. So we do several places of standard brush sampling. So these are little cytobrushes that get stuck down the tube. You collect the cells. We are looking very intensely at nasal epithelium as a surrogate for what's happening in the lung. We're pursuing that in a more detailed study going up. There's several papers, but again, that's not invasive. It would be great. It is one airway, so there's a lot of evidence that that'll be a good surrogate. When we brush, we then take it out and we stick it in RNA preservative. You can do large-scale sequencing of RNA and targeted exome sequencing from one brush. And then we stick it in the freezer and eventually we send it to Boston. And you can do it both in normal airway and around lesions. In terms of biopsies, what we've been doing, and I'll focus the ones in the lung, is that we take a sample of a lesion like I showed you and we send it to pathology, and then we go back and we take another forceps biopsy and we stick it in preservative and we stick it in the freezer. And what this allows us to do, again, is to sequence a full biopsy, and I'll talk a little bit about where we're going after this, but we do have these paired samples. Is it identical to the dysplasia? No, but usually the forceps are really small. there's 3 millimeter or less biopsies. So there usually is some residual dysplasia, metaplasia, whatever it was that we got, that gets it into the frozen sample. And again, we sample both normal airway and we sample lesions that we see in the lung. In addition, we are biobanking blood. So many of these patients go into the biorepository so that we can give serum samples to Santosh and Yun Wu to look at other markers of microRNA or circulating tumor cells and other risk factors that might predict who's going to progress. So the PCGA project really tapped into what we had been doing over the years. We take high-risk people who are smokers, may or may not have had a history of lung cancer, and who have another risk factor like positive family history, moderate to severe COPD, where doing a bronch is not contraindicated, and we've been sampling them over time. And what we've done is we've gone back to the same place. You know, the lung is very well mapped out. We actually have a picture of it for us to track where we took the sample. So if you have multiple openings, we know which opening we got the sample from. And we go back every 6 months or every year. So on average in our cohort of the 35 patients that came into PCGA, we had on average 3 bronchs that are over a series of 1.5 to 2 years. So it's that longitudinal way of looking at them and resampling in the same spot and resampling their normal airway as well as the lesions that has provided us with some very interesting data. So again, in that context, we go back to the same site, we do the paraffin biopsy that pathology looks at, and we determine whether that area progressed or regressed, or did it stay the same. And those are sort of the markers. We expect, in a normal situation with a normal lung, that you have an abnormality, and you repair that area, you slough off the dead epithelial cells, and the area should look normal. But there are a lot of lesions that stick around. Why? Because people don't necessarily do the DNA repair. They don't necessarily have a great immune system that targets these little lesions. And they've done some permanent damage that isn't reversed. You know, we have one patient who's had 2 cancers and about 15 carcinoma in situs, and as we've watched him over time, he has accumulated mutations in his pre-malignant lesions. Things that are like P53 mutations, KEAP1, a lot of the ones that that Santosh showed you. And that's because we've been able to do that because we have a lot of prospective looks. So again, the high-risk subjects undergoing lung cancer screening, we have 2 groups, one with a personal history of lung cancer or an upper airway, upper airway digestive with no evidence of disease, and then patients who are 50 or older, 20 pack years of exposure or more, our average is about 60, an additional risk factor. And we split the samples into 2 sets. So again, following with the model, you do one set where you sort of get an idea of what you're working with, and then you do a second set to sort of validate your findings. So this is kind of what our patients look like. They're men and women. We had 1 never smoker in each group. I'm not sure how they got in there, but it's okay. Several of the patients had a history of aerodigestive cancer. The majority of these were lung cancers. Most of these patients have some degree of COPD. And again, the average number of biopsies per patient was, between 5.5 and 6.8. Multiple bronchoscopies. Some patients had up to 6 bronchoscopies. The average time between biopsies between the 2 groups, and you can see that it really had some time behind it. So we actually got a fair number of biopsies per person. Our average over the lifetime of this cohort has been 4 biopsies at each bronch time. We got a lot of brush material, and we also had a lot of premalignant disease, and you can see it by histology. that really between metaplasia, mild dysplasia. And so this is the perfect group to look at premalignant disease. And this really maps out kind of what we did in terms of managing the informatics. We looked at 197 biopsies, doing QA/QC in terms of gene filtering, deriving a co-expression modules, filtering modules, and then we get down to confirm the phenotypes in subset 2, which is an additional 111 biopsies. And so what are some of the things we found? When you are looking at high score and low score, these are not just based on their histology, because you can see here in the low score there's a squamous cell carcinoma. But when we began to look in the second set of ones that had major pathways disrupted, they had characteristics of squamous cell carcinoma phenotype, we see the disruption in several genes are upregulated, and we also see disruption in the glycolysis cell cycle, Wnt signaling, P53 signaling, PI3 kinase signaling. A lot of these are exactly what you saw when Santosh presented, that are pathways related to adenocarcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma. But again, you can see from this that there's a distinct upregulation in the high-scoring lesions and a distinct downgrade of in the low-scoring lesions. And again, it's not just about pathology, because pathology, we needed to take into account multiple factors to actually distinguish the high and low risk lesions. So looking at alterations by histology grade, and then if we look at the lesions by whether they progressed or regressed, you can see that there's several other pathways that get pulled into this in terms of DNA repair, HIF-1 alpha, IL-12. There are 9 downregulated in stable or progressive lesions. And again, if you look at the JAK-STAT pathways, one, the NO2 dependent IL-12 pathways, natural killer cell pathways, these are very characteristic of cancers. And so that even early in a metaplasia or dysplasia that is stable, you can see that they are starting to have that phenotype of cancer. And again, if we look at grouping these genes to try and determine the 4 molecular subtypes, this dark blue, there it is the worst subtype. If you look at what genes seem to distinguish these molecular subtypes, again, you see some major pathways are plugged into here. This is in our second set, so these are in our validation cohort, that we can start to tease out, not just based on histology, not just based on progression, but we can begin to tease out these subtypes. And if you look at this worst subtype, and you look at in that group who's a progressor, who progresses or is stable, versus how they group for ones that regress, there are 120 genes downregulated in these lesions with progression in the high-grade subtype. And genes associated with major immune pathways seem to be downregulated in this high-risk subtype. So this kind of, not an immunologist, I took this to Scott Abrams and Kelvin Lee in immunology, say, does this make sense to you? And that in order for some of these premalignant lesions to progress or to be stable and not to be rescued by the immune system, they have to shut off some major immune pathways. And I think that's what we're starting to see. Going forward, my goal is not really to characterize people who are just at risk for lung cancer. I want to figure out where I can intervene with that group. And, this information, I am hoping will help me with a grant that I'm going to submit in September using one of the Cuban vaccines that essentially interferes with the EGF ligand that would start to downregulate the EGFR pathway and the downstream pathways, which we know are upregulated in cancers, but also very early in the premalignant pathway, to see if by changing or perturbing that pathway, can I reinvent or re-stimulate the immune system to start to target these high-grade, stable, or progressive premalignant lesions. So again, just from collecting biopsies and brushes, we are now sort of honing in on this phenotype of what we would consider to be a high-grade warning lesion that these patients may progress. We're going to start a second round of studies, again, looking at patients over a series of 3 sequential bronchoscopies to go back and interrogate many of the immune markers to do RNA sequencing. But now we're moving into a single-cell sequencing where we'll take fresh biopsies that we get from the lung, separate out the epithelial cells from the T cells and the other immune cells to see if some of the message that we're looking at in terms of this phenotype may be different among different cell types, because again, biopsies are a mixture of cells. They bring in different messages. So we want to begin to tease out what is the expression in just the immune cells versus what is the expression in the epithelial cells. Again, our goal is to identify patients at the highest risk for progression, but also to provide us with some targets that we can use either with Simovax or with some other drugs that are used to treat lung cancer. So we're going to continue to sample this cohort. We're progressing on to single-cell sequencing both for the biopsies and for the brushes. We're determining the hallmarks of what would be that initiation and progression in different populations to look at whether the transcriptome of African Americans is different than the transcriptome of Caucasians, because we know African Americans have a much higher burden of lung cancer for less smoking. We are taking some of this back into preclinical models. We had a nice model developed by one of our graduate students here who's in Boston that seems to mimic the premalignant squamous pathway. We're looking at RNA editing with Santosh from our data. We're also looking at these are not driven by mutations, but they may be driven by epigenetics. So we're starting to provide DNA to Joyce Ohm over in genetics. And again, targeting the EGFR pathway with Simovax to see if we can reverse some of this immune silencing in these lesions. These are just, I don't want to go over, and these are the collaborators that we have here at Roswell, and many collaborators, both at Jensen Oncology, which is J&J, who provided funding, and also a big group from Boston University who's been really fantastic to work with. Thank you. Do you have any questions? No? Okay. Thank you very much.